Hey, this is Gary Parrish, CBSSports.com. It's now Friday, March 20th, and this is the Eye on College Basketball podcast. And what a wonderful Thursday of the NCAA tournament. 2-14 seeds win. Big 12 goes 0-3, 5 1-point games. Wonderful father-son moment, a controversial call. Everything that people say when you ask them, what do you love about the NCAA tournament? They say they love about the NCAA tournament. It happened at some point yesterday between noon and, say, 1 a.m. Eastern. Just a terrific opening Thursday of this 68-team event. We could start anywhere, but I want to start with the goaltending call in the UCLA-SMU game. If you're the type of person who listens to a college basketball podcast, I'm assuming you know the deal by now. Matt Norlander and Sam Vecenie are here with me. Norlander, I'll start with you. Simple question, should that have been called goaltending at the end of the UCLA-SMU game?
I mean, that's a great question. I'm ready to answer it right away.
Good.
That's an inside joke only with the three of us. The listeners won't get. So, yeah, that was a bad call, in my opinion. I understand the call. I don't like it in real time. When this happened, I knew it was going to be, even before we got, by the way, this was like, what, 4:40 in the afternoon? We had so much other craziness that happened after this. But I knew it would be a leading topic here on the podcast. I don't like the call. There is no shot. That shot goes in. If you look at the trajectory, I mean, I watched the video a good 10 times. I squeezed it in amid all the other craziness that was happening, and that shot had zero chance of going in. At very best, if you want to say it had a chance to hit the rim, and that's where the technicality, the litigiousness of the call comes in, I understand. But just watch the shot. I mean, it will not go in. It did not have the parabolic arc. It did not have the correct line to hit the rim and have a chance to bounce up and bounce in. It had already kind of passed that point. At best, it was going to bounce sideways. Feel awful for Yannick Marrero, who tweeted out a few things, and we've got a few of those tweets on the site. If you read just Night Court or anything and you happen to miss them, it's actually really heartbreaking. That paired with the video of him saying it's all my fault and kind of breaking down at the podium, I mean, that's honestly like the worst of the tournament. But, you know, heartbreak comes with it. It really sucks. In my opinion, SMU should be playing, not UCLA. And I had UCLA winning, so, you know, whatever. But, you know, officiating controversy seems to be inevitable at some point in this tournament almost every single year. And I do find it just, you know, so oddly and unfortunately perfect that we get a call like this on a weird play like this, and it has to happen in the NCAA tournament. I just can't remember a goaltending call on a desperation heave of a three deciding a game. Like, I'm sure it's happened, and I'm sure maybe I've seen it before, but I can't remember it at the college level. So just funky timing. And, I, you know, plainly put, I don't agree with the call.
I think the first thing people need to understand is the rule, because immediately when this happens, folks are all over Twitter and they're yelling, that's absolutely goaltending. That ball was going to hit the rim. Well, hit the rim's got nothing to do with goaltending. Here's the rule. Goaltending occurs when a defensive player touches the ball during a field goal try and each of the following conditions is met. A, the ball is on its downward flight, and B, the ball is above the level of the ring and has the possibility, while in flight, of entering the basket and is not touching the cylinder. So let's start with A. Was the ball in downward flight? Of course it was in downward flight. Nobody's disputing that. But B is where the problem is. Was the ball above the level of the ring, and did it have the possibility, while in flight, of entering the basket? I'm with you, Norlander. We watch basketball every single day. That ball had no chance of entering the basket. Could it have hit the rim? Maybe. But even the way it was shot, if it hit the rim, it was scooting into the bench or somewhere like that. It had 0% chance of actually entering the rim. So it's an awful call. And I can't imagine anybody trying to convince me otherwise.
But let's try, Sam.
Yeah, Sam, if you want to explain to me that I'm seeing something I'm not seeing, or you're seeing something I'm not seeing, I'm happy to listen to you. Go.
Okay, so I think that Matt's right, and I think you're both right, and that you don't want a game to end like that. And I wish that they wouldn't have made the call in a lot of ways, just because you're right. I think that there was a 1%, like 0.0001% chance that shot was going in.
Zero.
Right?
No.
Zero.
No.
That's too high, Sam.
That's too high. It wasn't going in.
Whatever you want to say, that game was decided basically, and it was SMU probably going to win. Or at least they were going to get fouled, and then someone was going to have to go down and shoot free throws, and then UCLA was going to come back up and try and win it with 13 seconds left or whatever. So But the other thing is, I do think there's a legitimate argument for basket interference here.
That's because, fine, but they didn't call it. That's what they called it.
Yeah, they didn't call basket interference. But if you're going to go by the letter of the law again, I think that this was a violation. It was above the cylinder. It was above the still on its downward flight. And I think that there's a pretty realistic argument that it is a violation of some sort. You're going to call it, if you're going to call it a violation, they probably should have got the violation correct. But I do think that it probably was a violation and that the.
Okay, so you're going same church, different pew here then? You're going basket interference.
Okay, listen, if they would have called basket interference, then we could have an entirely different conversation. But they called goaltending, and so that means at best they missed a basket interference call. You know what they also missed? Yannick Moreira getting pushed in the back. So, like, referees miss calls all the time. So we're not debating whether or not they missed you know, the missed calls are a whole different deal. They called something incorrectly. They called it goaltending. And to any reasonable mind, that's not goaltending. If you want, I read the basket interference rule as well. You could make a better argument for basket interference than you could ever make for goaltending, but they call goaltending, and that is not goaltending.
And how about this? You can't review goaltending. So the weird thing is,
that's ridiculous.
Happened.
That is ridiculous.
This is the weird thing. Like, it's almost like the NFL went so long where you couldn't review or challenge turnovers or whatever. Now it's just an automatic booth review on a turnover, just because it saves everyone time and it's better that way. It's just so weird that you've got this huge moment and it happened, and I don't think we'll have a situation like this in the tournament again, where you have this game altering call, and as a viewer, you're sitting there waiting, and this did. I remember this happened last year, the year before. There was a big game where goaltending happened. Everyone was waiting for a review, and it didn't happen. So everyone's waiting for the Zebras to go over to the monitor, check it out. Meanwhile, the game just happens. Like, it was over really, really fast. So that's another, you know, on the laundry list of things that the rules committee needs to examine this year. I mean, goaltending really does need to be on that list. The fact that it is not a reviewable call is just bizarre at this point. And maybe, you know, sometimes it takes plays like this, but it needs to be, because you have to get this kind of stuff right. Because, you know, maybe you look at it, you say it's not goaltending, but it is basket interference, and you're able to make a different kind of judgment call in the moment. I don't know. But that was also the really bizarre angle to this. And you're right. Kevin Looney, jams Moreira in the back on the play. Just a really weird play. And, you know, one of just, a dozen freaking amazing games yesterday.
And I do feel sick for Yannick Moreira, because... And we were in studio last night at the CBS Broadcast Center talking about this. Like, you never get over that moment. Like, that kid was hurt last night, and I mean, he'll get over it in some ways. Like, he'll move on with his life, but it'll never go away. Like, even when you start talking about, you know, some of the biggest those type of moments in NCAA tournament history, the Weber one comes up, right? And at least if you're Chris Weber, you have that moment and people remember you for it. But you also have, like, all-star appearances and $100 million, and your entire career athletically isn't tied to that one thing. With Yannick Moreira, like, most people watching that game yesterday had never heard of him until yesterday. And this will be his defining moment athletically. And that's just awful, man, because I don't know, like, I don't know, maybe I'm weird, but I still remember athletic failings from my childhood, like striking out in a 12-year-old state tournament. Like, that still, it doesn't hold me back from doing what I want to do, but it's still in my head. I don't remember anything else about my entire 12-year-old season of baseball except striking out in the state tournament. I only remember that, and nobody else remembers it. Nobody else cares. Everybody has, you know, 12-year-old moments, but, like, my point is, there are some things that you just stick, they stick with you forever. And this one happened on the biggest stage. And if for no other reason, like, UCLA advances, SMU doesn't, whatever. Like, I that really doesn't bother me at all. But that kid having to be stuck with this forever because of an awful call by the officials, I hate that aspect of this.
Oh, yeah. And, yeah, hey, but good on him. I know, it's brutal. But good on him to... Go, I mean, he's not mandated to go to that podium in the postgame, but he did. And, you know, handle it about as well as you possibly could. So, you know, a weird one, but an amazing game. I mean, GP, if you want to, like, hit on the other stuff here that happened Thursday, because, you know, we're recording this shortly before Friday. People might even be listening to this midway through the Friday games. You had the benefit of sitting in a studio and getting to watch, you know, every possible game in the best possible way, because you'll have all those TVs in front of you. I mean, the big one, all right, it was a wild day. Most 1-point games ever in one day, NCAA tournament history, 5 of them, that set a record. It was actually a constant hum throughout the day. Like, we might have had one 30-minute period or so that was relatively calm, and then the final 20 minutes of the night when Georgetown, Eastern Washington got a little crazy, but Eastern Washington never threatened. Other than that, it was kind of like you had to be watching. I know I did. But saying all that, Georgia State's win over Baylor provided what will almost definitely have to be a top three moment of this tournament, an all-time moment, period. If Kentucky goes undefeated, that'll probably be the defining image. But it's hard to figure, but hey, this tournament, you never know. But RJ Hunter hitting a TJ Sorrentine-like three-pointer to give Georgia State a win, and in that moment, his dad, who would not even have been in that position if he didn't tear his Achilles. If he doesn't tear his Achilles celebrating the automatic bid, he's probably standing up and jumping, which is a great moment in and of itself, but it's not him needing to sit on a rolly stool on the sideline and legitimately and literally getting knocked off it as the crowd pops and explodes around him. It is an amazing image. So I don't know if you want to just get into that and what it was like to watch all the games there, but that was I just don't see it topping, being topped by anything the rest of the weekend, and was just an amazing March moment.
No, it was terrific. I mean, when you're a Sun Belt coach, any victory in the NCAA tournament is a huge moment. Like, it is, it could be, you know, the moment of your coaching career, and so to get that moment is awesome, independent of everything else. To get it because your son made it happen. I mean, geez. I mean, you guys aren't fathers. So, you know, it's hard to understand what, you know, how proud you can be of your kids over even the dumbest things until you're actually a father. Like, on that point, I used to always hear these stories of, I'm getting way off track here, but like parents would say stuff like, you know, you'd hear about a kid, like a baby or, you know, 4-year-old, 5-year-old, whatever, being sick, like, you know, cancer or something serious like that. And I would always hear like parents say, you know, if I could trade spots with them, I would. Like, that's sort of the go-to line, right? God, if I could trade spots with them, I would. And I was always like, that's crazy. I'm not taking anybody's cancer. You know, like, I wouldn't trade spots with anybody. I'd just be happy that I'm healthy. And then you have kids. And I'm being a little facetious, like, you know, but like, that was always my point of view. Like, no way, I wouldn't trade with anybody. How could you possibly care about somebody that much to genuinely be willing to trade those places with them? And then you have kids, and, you know, with my older son, we had a scare when he was younger, like when he was like 2 years old. It turned out to be nothing. He's healthy. Everything's perfect. But there was about a 2-week period where I've told this story before. I don't know about it on the podcast, so it's not a secret. We thought he may have a brain tumor. He didn't. It was a false whatever, but there was about a 2-week period where it was like, oh, wow, we might end up moving to St. Jude. And I just remember going, you know what? I would trade places with him. I would take the brain tumor. Like, that's my little boy. And so everything is just magnified once you become a parent. And I swear, I cannot imagine anything better, you know, at least in sports, than that moment that Ron Hunter got to enjoy yesterday. It's an awesome moment for RJ Hunter, but it's a moment for RJ Hunter. Like, you know, he's going to go on and play in the NBA and make shots, presumably, for a long, long time. But for, you know, for a dad to get that moment with his son on this stage was just fantastic. And I'm with you, Norlander. I do believe that Kentucky winning, if Kentucky wins and goes 40-0, something Kentucky, you know, related to Kentucky is going to be the lasting image. But I don't know that we'll get a better story than that father having that moment with his son on this stage. And even Ron yesterday when he went to the podium, like, you could just see how proud he was. That wasn't like a basketball coach up there celebrating a basketball win. That was a father up there celebrating an awesome moment with his son. And it was, in my mind, the best moment from yesterday and the sweetest moment from yesterday. Sam, your thoughts on watching Ron Hunter and RJ Hunter turn into March Madness stars?
That was unbelievable. I just stood up and screamed when he made that. He pulled up from, like, what, 35 feet?
Yeah.
That was unbelievable. I have no idea, like, what he was going for there.
The win, baby. He's going for the win.
He's going for the win.
When he shot it, though, I said, I did no yes. I went, no. Oh, my God. It was like one of those.
My God. Absolutely.
Except, you know what? I know, but, like, when you're such a pure shooter, and we were, Norland and I, at the LeBron camp last summer, he didn't shoot it well this year. I don't know if people realize that. He shot, like, 30% from three. But he's such a pure shooter that it's almost better for him to just get a clean look from there as opposed to, you know, take it up to, you know, 22 feet or whatever. Like, he had a clean look from there. Why not? I'm sure he takes that shot every day. So I wasn't as freaked out by the pull up, because when you're a natural shooter, to get a clean look from there, you got a clean look.
Yeah. Someone did that in the conference tournaments too. I can't remember who it was, and I thought it was probably the right move. It was more just the way this offensive possession went,
right,
where they had like 20 seconds, I think, and they didn't get within 35 feet of the hoop. And then he pulls up from 35 and it just goes anyway. That was really cool. And then the other thing that's really cool here is that the connections to Valparaiso and Bryce Drew's moment, sure, because Homer Drew was in the crowd. There was the father-son dynamic there. And then it was against Baylor, whose, you know, coach is Scott Drew. Bryce's brother and Homer's father, an assistant on that 98 Valpo team. And he said after the game, like, yeah, that now I've been a part of one of the best moments in NCAA tournament history and one of the worst. And I'll always remember both of them for different reasons. So it was just a crazy, crazy moment. It's an awesome moment for a kid that's probably going to be a first round pick this year if he decides to leave. And that was awesome. That was definitely the best moment of the day for me too.
Norlander, do you make a big deal out of the Big 12 going 0-3, or hey, it doesn't mean anything?
All right. Yeah, a couple thoughts on this. One, Big 12 goes 0-3. The state of Texas, by the way, goes 0-5 in a day and everyone's out, which is just nuts. I don't make a big deal out of this. To me, this is how you can kind of bring some stupid into the argument, because a 3-game sample size based off of, you know, a tournament where everyone's watching versus, you know, clearly 5 months of play against, you know, spanning across the sport. It's not a referendum on the Big 12. This is kind of always be a thing, though, because it's an easy talking point. It's an easy graphic to put up. To me, the Big 12 was still the best conference in the country, just because RJ Hunter hits an absolutely ridiculous shot, just because, guys, nobody had UAB beating Iowa State.
Nobody.
That was the automatic of automatic 3 over 14s. That happens, and that gets super overshadowed almost immediately by Georgia State winning. Yesterday was ridiculous. So I don't make I don't make too much of it. I really don't. This happened. Remember the year the Big East had 11 teams? It had 11 teams, and I think two made the Sweet 16, something like that.
Yeah.
So the Big East was ridiculous that year. So, no, I don't make too much of it. Was it an all-time epic conference? No, but, you know, kind of indisputably, no matter what you look at, the Big 12 top to bottom was the best league. Obviously, it did not have the caliber at the very top of the conference that, you know, the ACC might claim. And, you know, none of its best teams were as good as Wisconsin in the Big 10 or whatever. But I don't see how you could reasonably look at, you know, the outcome of 3 games on one day and say, man, yeah, the Big 12 – not even a top three league. This league was so overrated all year. That's not a fair or accurate way to evaluate.
I'm mostly in agreement with you. I'm not a big believer in drawing grand conclusions from what happens in this event. You know, the what happened in the Big 12 yesterday doesn't necessarily suggest anything about the Big 12 any more than Connecticut winning the national championship last year suggests Connecticut should have been a 1 seed in last year's NCAA tournament. This is just a single elimination tournament of 40-minute basketball games. It's fun, but it doesn't always prove what most championship events are designed to prove. That said, you know, people were popping Villanova a little bit. I know not you, Norlander, but some people, like, okay, fine. They put together, they got X amount of top 50 wins and X amount of top 100 wins, but who have they really beaten? They didn't beat any other top four seed in the NCAA tournament, except for Georgetown, and Georgetown's overseeded anyway. Like, that's what I heard. Have you looked at who the Big 12 beat outside of the league?
Off the top of my head, I couldn't tell you. Okay. Overall, I remember looking.
I looked it up yesterday, last night.
I remember looking in December and thinking it was fairly decent, but not like outstanding, and the numbers were really good.
It's fairly decent, but it's not outstanding. I don't think any Big 12 team had a non-league win. Any of the relevant Big 10, 12 teams had a non-league win over any other top three. I know over not over any other top three seed. Kansas has got one over Utah in Kansas City, and they beat Michigan State. Iowa State's got an Arkansas win. Baylor has a, I think it's Baylor, has a Stephen F. Austin win. There's not a whole lot there. Like, you know,
Kansas beat Georgetown too.
Yeah, Kansas beat Georgetown too. They got some wins over some four seeds, and down through the bracket. But the entire Big 12 has no non-league wins over top three seeds. And the best win of the entire group is probably Utah, you know, and that's Kansas over Utah, I believe, in Kansas City. So, like, hindsight is what it is, but when you go back and look at what they actually did outside of the league and then look at what happened on the first Thursday of the NCAA tournament, I think you can ask the question, did the Big 12 earn its reputation mostly because we, A, thought a lot of these schools were going to be good, and then B, they beat up on each other once they were all in, basically all inside the top 50. Like, outside of Kansas State, TCU, Texas Tech, everybody spent most of the year in the top 50 of the RPI. So every time you win a game, for the most part in the league, it's a top 50 win. Woohoo! And every time you lose a game in the league, unless you lost it to one of those three I just mentioned, and even at Kansas State, people were willing to excuse that. If you lost a game, it was like, hey, it's a loss inside the top 50. So you take a big picture look at the resume, and they got more top 50 wins than everybody, and they have barely any losses outside of the top 50, and you look up and there's six of them ranked in the top 25. But I wonder how much of it was, and I don't mean to say they manipulated the numbers because I don't think they did. Like, the numbers were just the numbers. But I wonder how much was just based off the numbers as opposed to these were really six of the best 25 basketball teams in the country. Sam, you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that you should take these three games and take a lot from them. I mean, they're three games. It's only three game sample size. It doesn't mean a whole lot in the grand scheme of things. Having said that, I've kind of been on the boat of saying that I thought the ACC was the best league anyway. Top to bottom, I would agree with you in saying the Big 12 is the best league, but I thought that the overwhelming talent at the top of the ACC was better, just period, this year. So I kind of figured that the ACC would succeed more in the tournament than say the Big 12 would. But I don't like the idea of doing like a last second look at it and being like, or putting on your Friday morning quarterback and saying, the Big 12 is overrated because they lost these three games by what, a combined, what, 10 points? They lost these three games, something like that.
Forget that, though. How about this? The Big 12 is overrated because when you go back and look at it, they really didn't do much outside of the league. Most of their quality wins are merely the product of coming against each other. I'm not saying that. I'm just wondering, is that a fair question?
I think it is. I mean, like I said, I've been kind of beating the drum saying the ACC was a better league generally. I mean, I don't know that I would go as far as to say it was a bad league. I still think it was the second best.
Yeah, no, you would not go as far as to say the Big 12 is a bad league. No.
No. Like, I wouldn't even go as far as to say that it was, like, a worse league than the Big East this year.
Just remember this. Remember this, like, with football this year, college football. The SEC, after it had an awful bowl performance, like Ole Miss gets, you know, loses, Mississippi State loses, Alabama loses, and people started going back and saying, okay, why did we think all these SEC schools were the best we've ever seen? Because they didn't really do anything outside of the league. It's just like they built reputations and then they all played each other and distorted our view of what was actually there. Turns out when they have to play other good teams from other good leagues, they're no different than the rest of us. Is that possible with the Big 12 here? Because again, when the entire league's best non-league win, and let me be clear, that I didn't go through the whole thing, but I went through the tops, like Kansas, Iowa State, Oklahoma, Baylor, so on and so forth. I just assumed that I didn't go through the whole league, but I went through the top half. I went through the basic NCAA tournament teams, and there aren't any great wins there in the non-league. Utah's the best one. Utah in your home state's the best win of all Big 12 non-league wins. And so I just wonder if it doesn't feel a little bit like SEC football. Nobody thinks SEC football sucks this past year, but did people think maybe SEC football got a little overrated? Like, you got to remember at one time the top four teams in the country in football were four SEC teams. And it was like Alabama, Auburn, Ole Miss, Mississippi State. And was that distorted because we weren't looking at it clearly? And what happened in the bowl games highlighted that. I'm just wondering if that same deal applies to the Big 12 in basketball right now.
To a certain extent, I think it might. Would also be interested in looking at Big East, ACC, Big Ten, and seeing comparatively how many wins those leagues had against teams, seeded fourth or better.
I did just look at the Big East. It's one. Providence beat Notre Dame.
Right.
Okay. So just generally speaking, so it could be relative to what we have here.
Duke would have a Wisconsin one.
Yeah. And Duke would have two. It would have Wisconsin, and it would have – actually, no, it would have three. It would have Wisconsin, Virginia, Notre Dame.
Well, he's talking.
Well, that's outside of league.
You're talking outside. Yeah, apologies on that. Yeah, you're right. So it would just have Wisconsin. Right. But regardless, kind of a crazy. I'm just looking at the bracket here. I mean, this. Yes.
Well, how about this? Like, look at the bracket right now, and then we'll get out of here. But it's so funny. The bracket comes out on Sunday night. We all like, what's the toughest region? Oh, look at this path this team's gonna have to take. And then we look up on Friday morning. Either Xavier or Georgia State is going to be in the Sweet 16. Either UCLA or UAB is going to be in the Sweet 16. So here we are.
Yeah.
The funniest thing about the UCLA-UAB thing is that was the last place game in the Battle for Atlantis in November.
Yeah, that's so funky. How about that? Yeah. That's ridiculous. I'm just going to tick off a few thoughts here, and then you guys can take it from wherever you want. LSU, absolutely LSU'd the LSU out of that game. They had zero business losing that game. I watched the majority of it.
Missed their last 12 field goals and their last six free throws,
and did not score in the final 4 minutes. And NC State has made a habit of winning weird postseason games like this. Do you remember the St. Louis game last year? Ridiculous.
Yeah, they blew it.
But this is just unreal. That was my primary game that I had on the TV for most of that second half watching yesterday. I didn't really care necessarily. I wasn't rooting for one team or another, but LSU losing actually made me I was getting angry. I can't even imagine what LSU fans must be going through. So Villanova plays NC State, yada, yada. Purdue had zero business losing to Cincinnati in the other 8-9 game on the other side of the bracket. They led by 8 with 48 seconds to go. They can't close it out. It gets to overtime. Cincinnati wins. Purdue would have been, Sam said on this podcast, Purdue had a chance to beat Kentucky, and now we're not even going to have.
I did not say that.
And now we're not going to get that. Listen, since he's going to try and just slog it out as much as possible, and try and take at least one lead like Hampton. Hampton did lead Kentucky at one point, but that is brutal for Purdue. It had no business when you're up by 8 with 48 seconds to go against a slow tempo team that can't shoot. You should not lose a game under any circumstances. Purdue very much did. You wonder if Hoiberg, I think he'll be back, but I'm saying will an NBA job open and has he coached his last gig? Rick Barnes, Texas looked awful. Butler played Butler ball. Rick Barnes got to think he's done. So Butler moves on to play, by the way, Notre Dame, Northeastern, that game was actually in doubt. That was the first game of the day. And we were like, oh, this is kind of awesome because we thought these 3 versus 4 teams would be a snore to start the day. And then look at everything that happened. Tournament is ridiculous. Just bonkers. That Notre Dame Northeastern feels like 2 years ago, and Notre Dame very well could have lost that game. Carolina Harvard almost feels like an afterthought. I mean, Harvard could have won the game. It's only a 2-point loss. Heels almost blew it. And then VCU Ohio State went to overtime, a 3-point game that went to overtime. D'Angelo Russell, the tournament is better for having him still in it. He was just insane to watch. I am so happy that we get to see him try and do what he does against Arizona on Saturday, a 5:15 game on CBS. And that doesn't even get into, we had other decent games. Arkansas, Wofford was enjoyable, if not slow. Wofford very well could have won it. Utah handled Stephen F. Austin. I lost 3 Sweet 16 teams yesterday. The tournament basically was everything we want it to be. It is quite simply amazing how this thing is foolproof in terms of not being incredible. Every single year, if it doesn't happen on the first Friday, it'll happen on Thursday, it'll happen on Friday. If we, for some reason, it almost never happens, get a boring round of 64, we'll make up to it by the time we get to a Sweet 16. Every single year, this tournament gives us at least 7 to 10 ridiculous games, and we're on pace for 20 at this point. I mean, I do a top 10 list of the best games of the tournament every year. I've already got half of it filled out to this point. I don't even understand how I'm not going to be able to keep it down to 10. So it was just amazing. I'm on like 3.5 hours of sleep. I'm rambling. I have like no food in my house, and I love this sport.
Wow, that was something, Norlander. You sound like you're going through it a little bit. You okay?
I'm going through some stuff over here, guys.
All right. Well, listen, go get some food and put it in your house, okay? Because, like, anybody that has a home should have food inside of that home. So I want you to go to do that. Sam, I want you to go read the goaltending rule call 100 times and then write it on a chalkboard and study it so that we don't have to debate whether that was goaltending or not yesterday.
Hey, I didn't debate if it was goaltending.
No, you make a good point about the basket interference thing. Had they called it basket interference, I think that's a much easier call to try to defend. But when they actually, like, the call is a goaltending call, I just don't I don't see how it's goaltending. But guess what? Now it's time to go do it all again. So you guys go do your thing. I'm going to do my thing. And then we'll meet back here either late Sunday or early Monday and look ahead to the Sweet 16. Till then, take care.